Hey there, M-Critters. This is Scott Weingart, and this is the M-Crit Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about cardiac arrest. Not the sexy stuff, not the treatment, but really the underlying science behind some of the decisions we make that have real ramifications for whether patients live or die. And I am joined to have that discussion with one of the smartest people I know when it comes to the science of resuscitation, my buddy, vice chair at Sharp Memorial, one of the first people to do ECMO in the ED, Zach Shiner. Before we get to that, a slight diversion, but a diversion apropos of our topic today. The Reanimate course. Every year in San Diego, we put on a course on resuscitative ECMO. How to do it, why to do it, all of the procedures and techniques that go into doing it. Basically, the first couple hours of an ECMO initiation. And every year, we sell out, and then I get countless emails from people begging for tickets. And yet, every year, the ticket sales all occur in the last, 3 or 4 weeks before the course. Well, that's not true. We sell a bunch of tickets early on, and then there's this lull, and then everyone buys their tickets right beforehand. If you are interested in this course, do not do that. Buy your tickets now, because I promise you it's going to sell out, and you will be very upset if you wait until the last minute, or at least that's what past experience has told us. So if you're interested in this course in San Diego, January 31st to February 1st, 2019, 2 days, you will, if you never did ECMO, but you're interested in upping your central line skills and becoming good at it and actually learning the way it's supposed to be done, because I promise you no one taught you the right way in residency, come to the course anyway. If you want to be better at cardiac arrest, come to the course. But if you are part of the M-Crit mailing list, I'm going to be sending out a discount code. And so you could should join the list ASAP and you'll get the discount code. But I am telling you, do not wait. If you wait, you'll be sadly disappointed. If you are interested in coming to the course this year, buy your tickets now. Go to reanimateconference.com. That address again, reanimateconference.com. All right, let's get to Zach talking about resuscitation science. We start off the conversation with a little bit about termination of resuscitation rules in the field.
Well, I think that that actually leads into what we were just saying, meaning that termination of resuscitation, we've been getting the creep from that is, I mean, I think it's in general a noble thing to try and think, okay, we don't want to bring all these dead people to the ER. And it started off as something that was unwitnessed arrest, no shockable rhythm at any point, and no ROSC. And it's kind of creeped into this no ROSC. If you don't get ROSC in the field, we're not bringing you. And so that's a nice thing to think about if you have no technological changes. Meaning if you're living in the Middle Ages and the technology changes once every, 100 years, great. Keep termination of resuscitations. If you're pushing the limits, which unfortunately in the last 40 years, we haven't pushed the limits in cardiac arrest survivorship, but I think we now are changing that. And if you are pushing the limits, then termination of resuscitation guidelines have some significant problems. And particularly when you have arrest that can survive at 60 minutes, you need to rethink whether termination resuscitation guidelines in a model where you have the ability to put somebody on ECMO makes sense.
Well, okay. So this is out of order, but I think it's pertinent to what we're talking about now. The current paradigm, as I understand it, in United States EMS is the predicated on the concept that there's not too much we could do in the hospital that they can't do in the field. So work them until the completion of a set treatment path. And then if they haven't gained ROSC and they fit that termination of resuscitation, stop in the field. Now, I think we've reached the point, and you alluded to the reasons why, where that's actually a detriment rather than a benefit. What is your feelings on that, Zach?
So I do think that in systems where you can offer something more in the hospital, in cities where you have the ability to set up resuscitation centers and namely include some of these advanced therapies like ECMO, that you should change these criteria. And Brian Grunow did a whole paper this last year on this, trying to decide at what point is the best point to transport. Now, there's no clear thing, and this may sound a little counterintuitive, but the patients you want to transport earlier are the sicker patients. So the asystole and PEA patients, they don't really benefit from being in the field. The VF and VT, maybe we should give them some great chest compressions, give them a few chances of getting shocked before we transport. This, like you said, alludes to a different question, which is, what do we think about these rhythms? VF, yes, it has a pretty good prognosis pre-hospital, but has an even better prognosis, or not an even better prognosis, but has a significant number of the survivors that we get are those types of refractory VF patients. Brian says we should transport somewhere around 16 minutes. The data on that is not compelling, and I think we need to look at that question a lot closer. But these asystole patients, where I think most of us think of this as a death sentence, the survival is somewhere, 0 to 2%, that we could actually improve that quite a bit if we could offer them some way to get perfusion. And that would probably be through putting them on some sort of circuit.
Now, the paper that Zach just mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode, as well as everything else we discuss. So there's a lot of stuff packed in there. That one study said if you transported 16 minutes, you will capture 90% of the patients who would have gotten ROSC prior to a potential ECMO initiation at the hospital. It's 50% at around 8 minutes. There's another paper that said the number is 21 minutes. What these papers are not looking at is, would you have gotten the same number of ROSCs if you put the patient on a mechanical compression device and just initiated transport after the first two shocks, say, or the first three? We don't have that information. And in addition to that papers, I think it would be fun to talk to Tom from Wake County about their data, because they have an amazing in-the-field ROSC rate. The next little bit we talk about is something that you might not appreciate if you're in EMS or maybe even EM, which is you look at all the work you do for your resuscitation, all of the perfect compressions and the lack of pauses. And what you need to realize for most patients, I mean, some of them will just wake up after ROSC, and then no one could really mess those patients up. But for most of your cardiac arrest patients, no matter how good your resuscitation is, and that might have been the key to their neurologically intact survival, that might all disappear if their critical care period is not done in a way that leads to survivors. Now, in many centers, either the patient wakes up right away or they give them a couple of days. And if they wake up, great. And if they don't, then they start talking to the family about withdrawing care. And what that leads to is you either have neurologically intact survivors or you have patients who expire in the hospital. And you're not sending anyone home in a survival but poor neurologic state, the CPC 3 to 5 group, or maybe 4 to 5, depending on your cutoff, because 3 is not horrible, but it's not great either. And the thing is, if you have that strategy, great, you're not going to have any patients in a vegetative state or neurologically devastated, but you're also probably missing out on neurologically intact survivors. And you really need to give these patients a chance, sometimes a very long period of chance. And it's always been my contention, and I have a little bit of evidence now to support this, but it's always been my belief, because I had these arguments with brilliant people in the hypothermia world, folks like Case Polderman and all sorts of folks who were very avid, John Rittenberger, about the actual hypothermic temperature for targeted temperature management. And they're like, look, we have all these people that don't wake up until the 3-week mark, and you'd miss these people. And it's always been my belief that no, it's just the opposite, that those patients, if they were given a normothermic TTM, would have woken up much sooner, and that hypothermia is actually putting you in an almost hibernation state. And we're actually causing these patients to take much longer to wake up. That's my belief. And those guys, I'm sure, will bash me for it. But I think that's what you're seeing. And in that case, you really need a critical care team if you're going to do hypothermic temperatures that are committed to the long haul. And if you don't have that, then no matter what work you do in the field or in the emergency department, then your survival rate's not going to be great for neurologically intact survival because they will all be withdrawn upon. So let's hear what Zach has to say about that.
I think what you're bringing up is the idea that in some scenarios, you have people in the ICU that are much more vested in the care of these patients than at other places. Yiannopoulos owns his patients in Minnesota. Lionel in Paris owns his patients. We don't own our patients in San Diego. And so does that change the aggressiveness of how you manage them upstairs? Impossible for me to know, but we can certainly conjecture that there might be differences in care. So do we actually pronounce too many people? And I think if you looked at our data set, you could argue that yes. Now, do we need to make some, in 2018, we need to make some idea of who we're going, how aggressive we're going to be with this management until we know better. I think we're doing a reasonable job, just like we're excluding asystole in most of these patients, in most of these cohorts. We don't really know what type of patient could survive if we gave them more time.
Absolutely. All right, let's go into prognosis because that's where this conversation is leading. And that's the main reason I wanted to talk to you about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the major prognostic factors we use for ECMO inclusion and in general for cardiac arrest is the no-flow time. And for the people who are not familiar with this terminology in the audience, no-flow would refer to the time with the patient in cardiac arrest where they're receiving no chest compressions. So the first question is there a no-flow time past which there is no hope for survival? Regardless, ECMO, non-ECMO, is there a no-flow time you just say they're not going to make it?
Yeah, so again, this gets back to data that we don't know. This is area that we don't have good understanding of. We have an understanding of what it looks like when you don't get ECMO. We know that if you have no flow time in more than 10 minutes, your prognosis is very bad. We also have the unfortunate problem of making bystander CPR a binary variable, meaning that you either got bystander CPR or you didn't. However, you probably got crappy bystander CPR most of the time. And if that's the case, it's as good as no flow or very similar to no flow.
And I'll just interject to say it goes the other way too, that we get these no flow time reports of 15 minutes and we assume, oh, this patient's dead. But there's no reason to think the patient necessarily was in cardiac arrest for those 15 minutes. They could have just been unconscious. The people on the scene, the family or friends didn't feel for a pulse, or even if they did it ineffectively. And the patient may have only been in cardiac arrest for 2 minutes.
So this data all gets confounded. Do I think that longer no flow times are possible for survival in the setting where you have mechanical circulatory support? The answer is yes. I think that we have not reached our limits as far as neuroprognosticating these patients. And we can't even decide if asystole or PEA should be in there. We are not even close to the level of saying when a prolonged no flow time is. Do I think that 10 minutes is still a reasonable idea for inclusion criteria? Yeah, I think probably right now, until we get more data, 10 minutes of no flow time is a reasonable cutoff.
And maybe with the proviso that Lionel puts in there, which is if they're longer than that but have signs of life, then that's a whole different ballgame.
Or with Yiannopoulos, where they do VF, which I think is, I think what we need to change is what do we think the possibilities for them are. Since we don't know what their bystander CPR quality was, and we don't know most of the time how accurate their downtime was, we can need to use other things. And so Lionel used signs of life. I think that's a wonderful thing. Yiannopoulos uses any VF patient. Doesn't matter if they had bystander disease. Doesn't matter if they're a witness. If they're in VF, I know it wasn't too long. I'm going to give those patients a shot. I think that's a better way to think about how we're prognosticating these patients.
I just want to summarize that because it's a super important set of points here. Yes, no flow time is bad. And the 10-minute cutoff most places are using to prognosticate badness is probably reasonable if you actually knew the patient was indeed pulseless and generating no forward flow during those 10 minutes, which you don't really know. So I think you need to add in the surrogates for a shorter time, which are as Lionel Lemieux is doing in Paris. If there's any spontaneous movement or signs of life, then that obviates the 10 minutes. Or what they're doing at Yiannopoulos' shop, which is if the patient's initial rhythm is ventricular fibrillation, then that portends a reasonable no-flow time. And we have a piece of literature on that in the show notes as well. So if your patient has 10 minutes without CPR and they're in a non-shockable rhythm and they have no signs of life, that is a horrible time zero prognosis. But if they have the absence of those bad signs, any one of them, then that's probably a patient who is potentially viable. All right, that's fair. So I think we're good on that one. Now let's get to the really interesting one. And that's low flow time. And for folks in the audience not familiar, low flow would refer to the less than ideal but still present flow of chest compressions. Now, before ECMO or without ECMO, Zach, let's talk about, is there a survival limit on low flow time? Is there a code that's just at some point you say they're not coming back regardless of what we do from this point?
Sure. So we have graphs that we can look at and say, what is the chance of your survival at 15 minutes? What's your chance of survival at 20 minutes, at 30 minutes? And in all comers, this gets very low at 30 minutes. It gets down to less than 5% and most of the time less than 1%. Now, Josh Reynolds did a great paper that looked at, well, what about these best patients? What about the patients who meet the criteria of ECMO, meaning that they had a witnessed arrest, they had an age less than this, and you know, all the good factors. And he showed the same thing. At 30 minutes, they still have a horrible prognosis. And at 45 minutes, very few people are even running these arrests. So the confidence intervals go sky high. But it's still probably less than 1%.
It's worthwhile to take a look at the Reynolds paper. For me, looking at the graphs, I don't know if it's as dismal as 1% beyond 30 minutes. Their longest neurologically intact survivor had 47 minutes of low flow time. And it looks somewhere at the 5% range, looking at these graphs of people going beyond 30 minutes to still have neurologically intact survival. Now, if you look at the Wake County data, and I'll put a link to a PDF in the show notes, that's also interesting. But be aware when you look at those numbers, and they're very proud justifiably of those numbers are from the time of dispatch. So there's a period of time added to their the times comparable in the low flow studies. So when you see 47 minutes in their study, there may have been 10 minutes of time to dispatch. So it's really comparable to a 37-minute time in, for instance, the Reynolds study. So just be aware of that when you take a look.
And so if you're not getting mechanical circulatory support at the 30 to 45 minute range, I think your chance of survival will be less than 1%, even in the great patients. And so it's probably reasonable somewhere in that time frame to stop.
And this might be why we've seen the termination of resuscitation algorithms come, because of data like this. Now, does that data change with ECMO?
It absolutely changes. I mean, all of the studies have people with more than these downtimes. Our average downtime is 52 minutes. Dimitri's average downtime is 66 minutes. And Lionel, when he first had to wait 30 minutes before he even got to start ECMO, his downtimes were like 90 minutes. And people are surviving. 20 to 30% of these patients are surviving. So just like the thumbnail, like look at this, says something doesn't add up. This either we are grossly overlooking some variable in the ECMO patients, or this stuff is a game changer.
I realize it might be irksome that we keep mentioning these names and you have no idea who we're talking about potentially. So Lionel runs the Paris SAMU field ECMO program. If there's a cardiac arrest in Paris, they get called and they actually initiate in the field. They've had amazing success. And then Dimitri Yiannopoulos is in Minnesota, and he has to date the best out-of-hospital VFib neurologically intact survival ECMO rates somewhere in the 44% range, which is crazy because these are people that have already failed conventional ACLS resuscitation. Is it possible that the reason this could be explained is that after 30 minutes of low flow, the chance of the body being able to maintain itself is virtually nil. But the brain on that patient could have come back. It's just that there's no way they're going to live for that to happen. And ECMO makes that transition possible. It gets them through the cardiac stunning and allows the brain time to recover. Is that the possible explanation for this?
Yeah. So we look at a lot of these trials, the EPI trials. We say, okay, they all get ROSC, or about, you know, 30% of them get ROSC, but they don't walk out of the hospital. They're neurologically devastated. And one of the ways that we see this now that you get them on the pump is you see this post cardiac arrest myocardial stunning, that their heart, their EF goes down to 10% and it stays there for 3, 4, 5 days. And unless you have somebody on something that's going to augment their circulation, bodies are not made to withstand pressors for that long. So I think that that is one of the key things, is that this ECMO actually gets you through that cardiac stunning for the first, you know, several days after your arrest.
And I'll take that a step further and say that, you know, we compare cardiac arrest cohorts to places that are getting the best rates out there, places like Wake County, places like Seattle. And we attribute it to the amazing skill of things like PIT crew, CPR, continuous chest compressions, cardiocerebral resuscitation, and all these amazing things. And I'm sure those play an enormous role. But the confounder, the things that these places share, is an amazing rate of bystander CPR, much higher than you'll see in other parts of the country. Those go hand in hand. Is it possible that a lot of our patients, if they don't get bystander CPR, would still have viable brains, but without the bystander CPR, they will just never make it through their hospital course? That lacking that puts them in this mode of a body that can no longer support itself for 4 or 5 days, and that putting those patients on pump will get them through and their brains will survive, and that those are in places without bystander CPR. In the bystander CPR places, it's very possible the heart never has that degree of cardiac stunning, even if their time of low flow is the same, and therefore they make it regardless of ECMO. Is that the difference? That it may not necessarily be the quality of the resuscitation so much as the time spent at no flow that makes the enormous difference in these places. That's just something to think about. I don't know if it's the case, and I'm sure it's a multifactorial situation. All right. Now, let's start to the area that you've blown my mind on a number of occasions, and I want you to do the same for the audience, which is parsing through the statistics on actual cardiac arrest survival, especially in the VF and VT patients. And you've told me numerous times that the numbers are lying, that the way you look at this totally changes your viewpoint on understanding this concept. So what is the difference between survival in VF on the full cohort versus the patients after one or two shocks?
So once you get into the refractory VF patients, and I don't really believe, people don't stay in VF. They go in and out of various rhythms. And this actually has some implications in a negative way towards our ECMO survival, meaning that if you get intermittent ROSC during your arrest, your chance of survival is 3 times greater than if you didn't. So those patients, and you see a lot of these in Minnesota, is that if you get recurrent ROSC, your chance of survival goes way, way up. And so those types of patients, while we think, well, maybe we could just, you know, prolong their arrest, it turns out that if you don't get them past that myocardial stunning, that they don't survive. And that's why a lot of the literature doesn't bear out to just keep going on VF patients. There are significant diminishing returns after the first couple shocks. I would say, as the caveat to that, is make sure you do the shocks well, because defibrillators work very well. Make sure you get them in the right place, all this stuff, before you ever call somebody refractory VF. But once you have a patient that you think is refractory VF, you should transport. You should transport in a system of care where you have a mechanical circulatory device. And this is probably at the 10 to 15 minute range. If you're Brian, you'll say 16 minutes. And so, yes, there are diminishing returns once you get past your first initial shocks. And at that point, you need to start thinking about doing something different.
All right. So if I'm trying to contextualize this, what you're saying is that some systems have very good VF, VT survival, but if we look at those same systems on their patients who do not immediately respond, because many of these patients, they go to VFib, you find them, it might even be witnessed by the medics, you shock them, they're back, they have ROSC, and that's one group. And it, so
and that contributes to a significant number of the survivors of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
And if you strip those patients out, now all of a sudden those same systems will have dismal VFVT survival rates unless something different is done.
True, 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 true. And I think this also plays out in PEA. The PEA, you know, you've got these two different cohorts. You've got the patients who are really just hypovolemic, or they're just shocky. We can't palpate a pulse. And they have a really good survival, you know, 40% if you do it right. And then there's the EMD and the asystole patients. And these patients, if you look at why they die, so what is the etiology of the asystole patients? We don't know of all the ones that die because we don't have that data. But on the ones that survive, about a third of them are acute coronary syndrome. And so they were just in VF, and then we found them 2 minutes later, and now they're in asystole. And that type of patient probably has a similar prognosis to the VF patient if you can get them on a device quickly enough.
Mm. And so I guess if we really wanted to acid test that latter concept, we've treat all asystole as pretty much the same. But if you had a patient with a witnessed arrest in front of you in the department and their first rhythm was asystole, there's not too much reason to posit that patient would be that much different from any other rhythm in front of you.
Exactly, Scott. I mean, that I think you nailed it right there, is that asystole's prognosis is the same if you can start perfusing them. In fact, they might have open coronaries. Like, let's say it was a respiratory arrest, or it was asystole has numerous different etiologies, but if it was one of the other different types, if you got them on the pump, you could fix this problem quite easily.
You know, PEA is the interesting one, right? Because many ECMO protocols exclude these patients, and yet this is the way most of the pulmonary embolisms I've dealt with have presented. And those are completely viable patients. They have a reversible cause. And if you could get them in time, you could save these patients' lives. Why do you think many of these protocols are excluding PEA?
Well, every program that I know has the same issue. We are walking a tightrope between being a successful program and being one that wants to get shut down. And so what you need is you need success. And Dimitri has shown this so well. He's shown that if I take a really good patient population that's still expected to die and I get really good numbers, my hospital loves me. And if you start including some of these PEA patients, and especially asystole patients, yes, your survival is going to be lower. However, you will have a number of saves there. So I think with where we currently are, we're probably right to the point where we can start pushing this envelope and saying, hey, maybe these PEA and maybe these asystole patients can do better. And at Sharp, we do PEA patients. And PEA patients have been, I can't remember the exact number, but a number of our survivors' initial rhythm was PEA. And in fact, even one of our survivors was asystole.
Absolutely. All right. Zach, let me ask you this. I had a conversation with a very knowledgeable and caring CT surgeon, and we were discussing whether or not to initiate on a patient. And what came up was that, you know, if I had to estimate, I'd give this patient a 1 in 20 shot of walking out of here. And for me, that was a good number. And for him or her, they were like, no, that's not enough to make it worthwhile to do this. If you had to pick a number for a cohort for neurologically intact survival, what is your number to make ECMO worthwhile? Is 1 in 20 good enough?
That is a great question. And I know this will probably sound bad to some ears, but quality adjusted life years is a reasonable metric. I mean, cost per quality adjusted life year is a thing that we use all over the place. I was just sitting on the plane next to a guy who does Fabry's disease. And, you know, the cost per year is $250,000 for this drug. And when you look at the ECMO data, it's way better than that. The quality adjusted life year number is way better. In fact, out of hospital cardiac arrest, I think there was a paper just this last month in association showed that it's one third the cost if you do an out of hospital cardiac arrest versus an in hospital cardiac arrest for cost. And this is at, this is like 80,000 euros, I think is what it was, a fraction of what we're paying for other things. So if we want to say, what is the amount of money that we are willing to pay per quality adjusted life year, then ECMO makes sense. And it makes sense actually in quite a significant amount of money compared to other things. It's always cheaper for someone to die. And so we really need to say, what are we willing to spend per life saved? And in my opinion, cardiac arrest has some pretty good bang for the buck.
Okay, so that's fascinating. And that's probably the right way to evaluate these issues. It is, though, the bigger picture way. You know, quality adjusted life years has always struck me as a systems-based thinking. It's
sure.
The way ethicists and economists should think about it. As a line grunt, what I always think about is, am I giving my patient a shot in the way that will not hurt my hospital financially and therefore they will shut us down? And from that perspective, you could really argue, at least in the United States where there's reimbursement, that ECMO makes a lot of sense. And then if you factor in organ donation, then that opens up a whole increased range of beneficence. But you haven't answered my question, Zach. You gave a very good way of evaluating my question, but you're on the spot here and you looked at the numbers. You're one of the smartest people I know on this stuff. And it comes out to 1 in 20. Is that worthwhile for Zach Shiner from the perspective of a line doc, not Zach Shiner as a systems-based engineer?
5%? Absolutely.
Okay.
5%, absolutely. I mean, we look at the TOR guidelines, they used less than 1% survival as their accepted survival. So 5%, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, go for it.
Now, when we extrapolate that, what is the number that will keep the ICU nurses from hating you as the initiator of ECMO? Is it still 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 20%?
No, it's honestly, it's probably above 20%, and it probably makes a big deal also of what those survivors were. Like, did you allow the whole ICU to meet the survivor when they left the hospital? Because people remember the last thing they saw, and when they see, like at our hospital, you know, people walk out of the hospital that they said for sure were dead, and then they get to meet their families. Just like you and me, the line docs, when we are talking to the family and we're seeing them all in the room and they're all, you know, flustered. I think that is an important piece of every resuscitative program, is making sure people understand, yes, people die and you will have sat with them for 4 days or 5 days at a time. And so that's going to be pertinent in your mind. But you need to also see the successes and you need to see them in full effect with their families and whatnot.
All right, folks, I think we'll wrap there. So much more we could talk about, but we're getting really long on time. Remember, if this stuff is of interest to you, then the Reanimate course is probably of interest to you. Sign up, reanimateconference.com, reanimateconference.com, and check your emails if you're part of the MCRIT mailing list for a discount code. This has been Scott Weingart with Zach Shiner for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.